If you would like to attend the course that James Lindsay and I will be co-teaching on critical race theory at Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com/courses to enroll now. I'll see you in class. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Right now, when it seems as if society is devolving into a race war that will destroy us all, we are also seeing the emergence of a global working-class revolution that promises to liberate us all. But will it? These are the questions for this week's guest. This is my interview with James Lindsay. I am joined from Knoxville, Tennessee, by my good friend James Lindsay. Although I think I'm going to start off by criticizing you a little bit. Is that all right? You're used to that.
Yeah, we do that sometimes here.
You seem to me, my friend, is like especially immune to that kind of stuff. You seem less sensitive than I am to criticism.
No. Well, you know, you pick up enough scabs, they turn into calluses.
Is that what it is?
I think so. That and you know, through my study, I've gained confidence. And when you're confident, like I don't talk a lot about things that I'm not pretty sure about. And so, you know, if people want to try to criticize things that I've said, you know, I know what I said and why I said it. I don't guarantee that I'm right, but I do know the reasons why I said it most of the time, at least, you know, enough to where the criticism doesn't hit like a sore spot because I know what I was doing when I know where I came from. So it doesn't hit insecurity. So it doesn't bother me, but also it's just been so much of it, you know, it's like you just kind of transcend it after a while. It's just noises that the internet makes in your direction.
Well, here's another reason I think is that you're winning.
That might be true.
Makes it easier, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I'm screaming into the wind anymore. Like it used to be so frustrating, and I actually, the gaslighting worked on me because nobody saw what was going on, whether, you know, whichever these subjects, critical race theory, you know, the broader weird political stuff, whatever it happens to be. And now people at least have a pretty good inkling that something bad is going on. And so the gaslighting doesn't work, you know?
Yeah. I do definitely want to talk about sort of what's going to happen to the Democratic Party over the next year, because I've been fielding predictions from people. I have my own, but I want to hear yours. But before we get into that, let's talk about what's been going on with you lately. So the big news is that you got a book coming out.
Yeah, they do. On the 15th, The Race Marxism will be the title. So I assume that might be what you want to criticize me about, but
yeah,
I have a pretend copy we're checking the typesetting. So it will look approximately like this. The big gray bar across race will not be there. That's where it says this item not for sale, because it's a proof copy. But so other than that,
hold it up again. So for those who are only listening, it's fairly important, actually.
It's the netball flag, national bolshevism flag.
Yeah, I think we should judge books by their cover more often. So this says race, Marxism, big words. And then under that is the hammer and sickle. And then it's all red. The whole cover's red. And then under that's James Lindsay. Fairly subtle.
There are tiny words at the top that say the truth about critical race theory and
the truth.
The truth.
Oh, man.
I know how you love truth.
I know. So that I got to say, your cover triggers me in three or four different ways.
Do it.
And if I didn't know you, like if this were like 2 years ago before I knew you, I'd have been like, exactly why I'm not going to talk to this fucker. But let's get
into
it.
Yeah, I've got some of that from people. I like the triggery title or cover though.
No, I know. This is
actually, I wanted a bold cover.
This is actually kind of what I want to talk to you about because so Ben Burgess teaches at Renegade University. And so do you, and you will be with me teaching a course on critical race theory soon next week and beginning next week. And you guys are not fans of each other. At least Ben is certainly not a fan of yours. He's actually devoted, I think, entire episodes of his show to criticizing you on these issues.
Well, okay. But,
his gist is, and the gist from the left, which is Ben is on the left. About you that I've noticed is that you're just stupid. It's not so much. I can't remember. I mean, there's certainly Ben does a good job of attacking your arguments. I mean, at least Ben attempts that. Like many don't do that. They'll just say he's just dumb. But there is sort of a dismissiveness, I think, even in Ben's tone, which I've brought up with him actually. And like I'm caught in the middle here because, you know, I come from the left, and so I have their sensitivities and sensibilities about things like your cover and your self-presentation, which I get. Like my old self would have been triggered like that, you know, since I've experienced so many people like you, you know, and you directly, we've co-taught a course together. You've been on the show several times, et cetera. I know you and I know how you think and I know how rigorous you are. I mean, you're phenomenally rigorous, James. I think like, I doubt there's any person who has read as much critical race theory as you have.
I've read a lot. Like, I mean, I don't think some people have, but I've read a lot.
I don't think Kimberly Crenshaw and Derek Bell have read as much as you have. You've exhausted the literature.
Yeah, I mean, not all the little papers in the universe, because those are probably literally infinite if we're going to talk about false mathematical claims, but there are a lot of them. But I've read the major works, certainly. You know, all of them, most of them more than once.
And extremely carefully.
Yes. And in reference to, you know, going back and reading older things like Marcuse or Horkheimer or Marx or, you know, whatever. So
I think you're the leading scholar on CRT. I know you're the leading scholar on CRT because you're not within it. So you actually have, you know, an outsider view. One might call that an objective analysis. I don't call it that. But you know, certainly you are outside of it. And therefore, I think you have a much clearer vision of it and clearer take on it. So I was thinking about, you know, I was trying to talk to my friends on the left who think you're a knucklehead about, like, you know, I'm kind of like, they kind of are, I think they're disappointed in me for even like entertaining you, whatever. But, and I want to say to them, I have said to them, I said, you've got to read his actual work. I mean, you know, really read it. Sam, your nemesis, Sam, what's his name? Hodley Brill, like actually took our RU course. He paid money just so he could criticize you. But once he, see, this is the interesting thing, man. Remember when he was in the course, he was actually very civil and polite and very respectful towards you. And
he raised some good points too. I even
raised some great points. I was like, when we're actually face-to-face talking, like we do in RU courses, like that's what comes out. It's this beautiful stuff where our politics are radically different, but people see things differently. Then of course, 2 days later, Sam is going on Twitter about how idiotic you are about this or that thing. And he's obsessed with you. I think almost every day he tweets about you. Sam is a graduate student at CUNY in philosophy, I think. So here's what I think's partly going on. I think it's partly your fault. And I mean,
definitely
it's your choice as to how you present yourself on Twitter, especially, right?
Correct.
You are like most of us on Twitter. We're more provocative there than we are in other forums, right? And you kind of like throw some bombs in there, and you're not so worried about being rigorous and having your citations and demonstrating your knowledge of the literature. And, you know, you're a little bit of a bomb thrower on Twitter. It seems to me deliberate.
It is a little.
Yeah.
There's also a disposition behind it. At some point in the past couple of years, and I don't remember exactly when, I just decided that Twitter doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's just a river of noise, really. And not to say it doesn't have impacts, but it just doesn't matter. And so there's almost an,
that's contradictory. What do you mean?
Well, it is a bit contradictory, but it's of, you know, if somebody says something incorrect on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. I don't actually think that that matters almost at all. First of all, it's going to get just jumped on by everybody in the universe,
right?
Unless they're, you know, completely ignored, in which case, who cares? Anybody that's ignored can say anything because it doesn't have any impact, but it's going to get jumped all over. I actually have come to this point where I think that I'm not afraid of what they say, misinformation anymore, people getting things wrong, because what happens is that the beauty of social media, when it's not being censored and biased and every other thing, is that these claims, like misinformation, is actually way less of a problem. Because what it is actually putting stuff into a space that's very much like I hate to use the phrasing, but I think it's a good one, a real marketplace of ideas where things adds up. Yeah. Actually, you know, false claims get jumped on very, very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And people can be disabused of something very quickly. And then the other thing with Twitter is, like, I tweet an absurd amount. Everybody knows this. It's unhealthy. Joe Rogan even was like, dude, touch grass or whatever when I was on his show last week. He didn't quite say touch grass, but he was like, wake up. And at the very end, he's like, I love your Twitter, but dude, you tweet all day. And it's like, well, it's sort of my like playtime or whatever. But the truth is, it's like, I can't, if I want to find something that was like more than 2 days ago on Twitter, it's gone.
Hmm.
And so if we were just having dialogue, right? No recording, you know, Zoom's got a recording on it. If we were just talking at the bar, right? It doesn't really matter if one of us says something stupid because it's just in the past. It's just gone.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's technically on Twitter, but nobody finds it. Nobody looks except to like anything older than like a few days old. Nobody looks except to pick on it. And at which point it's just critical. And right. So it's like, it doesn't matter. It's like, it has this veneer of mattering while underneath at its core, at its essence, what's happening on Twitter is pretty irrelevant. It's pretty ephemeral. And so it's, it frees you up to have fun with the medium and to, you know, to test some shit sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm going to put it in a book, I'm going to get the citation. If I'm going to put it in like a podcast form, I want to make sure I get it from the original sources or whatever. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to put it out there in writing, you know, but I know Twitter is technically in writing, but it's like, it's not, it's brain farts. That was what the platform was originally conceived to be, just a place where people could go hang out socially with their brain farts. And so I'm like, I can just have a little fun with it. And it's, there's a degree where it's like, I'm just kind of, most of the stuff I tweet is pretty serious. Like I think through it. Some of it's flippant because I still feel like there's not enough like informed flippancy. It's just this culture of respectability that's
totally
got everybody in chains. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to, you know, as they would say in the old days, rustle some jimmies around that. But on the other hand, there's also experiments. Like I literally type some tweets sometimes that I know are a little bit spicy or a little bit like edgy or a little bit, maybe not even like experimental is the right word. Mm-hmm. And I literally sometimes have said to my wife, like, look what I just typed. Let's see what happens. And then go. And it's just, let's see what happens. And I'm not afraid to put information out there with a, let's see what happens attitude. And sometimes, you know, I get ratioed and so we see what happened. And sometimes I'm spot on.
The good news is, at least for me, I found out this last year that these Twitter mobs can actually come and go and then people forget about it just a few months later. You're right. It's very ephemeral. I mean, I thought last summer I got completely jumped on Twitter. It was pretty bad for a while. And I was worried. I was like thinking, God, is this going to like have an effect on my business, on my career, on people going to come try to kill me? And then a couple months later, 3 months later, I noticed it just sort of dropped away and I haven't heard anything about it in months now. People seem to have forgotten about it. And meanwhile, I'm getting more and more Twitter followers. So it didn't seem to do anything, but yeah, it's a good thing. I guess it's simply like it's unveiling the casual conversations, that are about everywhere. It's sort of like if you just had a microphone in every office, at every chair, you know, of all the policymakers and all the people who think about these things, and you just open the mic for, you know, it's, you sort of hear everything that's in the air, right? Which much of it's ephemeral, but what's important is you can take the temperature of certain people, certain movements, certain things, institutions, you know, and that's where it's really useful.
Yeah.
But so in terms of lasting like, effect, I don't know.
There's like a vibe where it's like, if somebody's telling you, you can't do that. And the reason, you think through the reasons, and the reasons seem a little bit arbitrary. It's like, well, why not? You know, let's be the velociraptor and stick her face on the electric fence. I know it's not how they would work in reality, but we saw the film. We saw the fake movie. You know, let's see what happens. Let's find the weaknesses. Let's poke around. Let's Well, let's have some fun here.
Also, I mean, you don't have much to lose. You don't have an employer.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Yeah. I kind of erect, I mean, I could get canceled by one of the crowdfunding sources or whatever, but that probably in the long run work out to my benefit.
Yeah. And you're an independent operator anyway. Like, you don't have your own podcast to get canceled. You don't have your own YouTube channel to get canceled. Right.
Correct. Correct.
You're just going, you're a guest and you're just, which is the best way to be. I mean, you're totally independent in that way. So that's helpful. All right. Let's get down to your book. This fucking cover, man. I swear to God, I would have hated you for that. Okay. So it's about critical race theory, which you have become very famous for recently. I'd say you're right up. I mean, you and Chris Rufo are pretty much, I'd say, equal in your fame about that. Although you've been famous about other stuff for longer. So anyway, it's about that. So you call it Marxism. Race Marxism.
Excuse me.
Race Marxism.
Yes, I do.
Now, listen, Mr. Lindsay, Ben Burgess and I just taught a course on Marx. So I know about Marx. Let's do the argument. I don't want to spend this whole episode on this, but why is critical race theory Marxism? Why is it race Marxism?
Well, the race part's obvious.
Yes, I'll give you that.
Okay, so the race part's obvious. Okay. So there's a number of different ways I could frame this to make this case. It's probably actually best to start kind of with the basic structure of Marxism and then look at what's going on. The bridge will be from a paper, Gloria Ladson Billings, critical race theory and education activist, still active, et cetera. She wrote the paper in 1995 titled Toward a Critical Race Theory of Education with William Tate IV. In that paper, she explains that the idea behind critical race theory is to make race the central construct for understanding inequality. And so if you start with the idea that Marxism has something to do with understanding economic class and your position as such as the construct, the central construct for understanding inequality, and then we shift to where we now understand even issues of class through a lens of race, then you can see the bridge. So that's the kind of simple, like superficial transition there. But if we go back to Marx, you know, and try to boil Marxism down to something fairly simple, mm-hmm. you have this idea of a working class that does all the productive labor. They produce literally the materials, the material conditions of, well, not the conditions, they produce the material substrate of society, everything people mm-hmm. need to meet their needs. You have workers with their hammers, hammering away and doing things. You have workers with their sickles, harvesting food, working away, and they're doing the productive work in society. Then you have all these people who, these people occupy what Marx would have called the base, the economic base of society. It later got sometimes called the infrastructure of society. Mm-hmm. And then that would be the structuralist reinterpretation. Mm-hmm. And then Marx said that you have these other people who have these kind of managerial jobs through the division of labor. They come in and they say, well, you know what? Instead of swinging your hammer for yourself or swinging your sickle for yourself, come in, swing your hammer for me, and we're going to make different kinds of products and I'll pay you money. So now what's happening is those people are bringing their vision into the world through the hands of others, right? And so mm-hmm. now work becomes labor. Mm-hmm. And in the process of transforming work into labor, as Marx would kind of have, he doesn't use the language that clearly, but I think it helps to separate. You have exploitation going on, that the not only is there a, is the person that's producing, that's doing the work, producing the value, the labor theory mm-hmm. of value, mm-hmm. And thus being paid, if profits are coming out of it, being paid less than it's actually worth, so thus being exploited. But also Marx believed, if you read, for example, the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts or 1844 manuscripts, mm-hmm. he believed that there's almost a spiritual component to what work does for you. You visualize in your mind what you want to see in the world. You mm-hmm. produce as a subject. You have that vision that you produce an object mm-hmm. in the objective world through your work. That's what differentiates you in the activity that you engage in as work from the activity that animals engage in. So honey or bees might make a very complicated honeycomb and a hive, and they're obviously busy as bees, as one would say. Mm-hmm. But they're not doing work because they don't have a vision of this thing. They're just instinctually doing whatever bees do. And they make this and this kind of constant activity, and they do it to meet their basic needs. not to bring a vision into the world. Whereas human beings have a conscious vision of what they want to, see in the world. They see that tree and they think that could be furniture or that could be a cabin. Mm-hmm. And if I go out and I chop the tree down and I shape the wood and fashion and put my labor and effort into it, then I can produce this thing. Right. And so then what you have in that, that's the base. And then the superstructure, you have these people working in it that are organizing, they're managing, they're doing law to mediate between people. They're priests to explain why, you know, to give people explanations for mm-hmm. why their life is as terrible as it is, but why they should suffer in gladness with the opium of the masses. You know, that's his critique of Hegel's philosophy of right. Mm-hmm. And those people, according to Marx, are not doing productive work. They're exploiting the people doing productive work. And so to justify why they're exploiting people, they create a mythology called the ideology, or maybe mm-hmm. multiple ideologies. Religion is an ideology, for example, that justifies mm-hmm. why you need priests to minister right. to people spiritually, et cetera.
Right.
Law is an ideology that explains why you need lawyers to mediate mm-hmm. between these people, where the workers should be able to be on the same team and you don't really need this stuff. You don't really need managers. The division of labor is in fact kind of the place where he sees that the subject and object become split, the practical and theoretical divorce from one another. And you end up with all of the contradictions of the dialectical relationship there. So you have the superstructure produces, and the people working in it produce an ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And that ideology is designed to justify their superior position and to continue the oppression and exploitation of the masses, who, in addition to having their labor exploited because they're not getting paid enough, are being alienated from mm-hmm. the product of their labor.
Yep.
And from the society and from each other. Yep. And from the workers, they're yep. for the bosses. So, because mm-hmm. for Marx, that work has, that's where you come to know yourself as a man. So you become as man. And so that's where you become alienated from yourself, even as your species or and you can't see yourself as a species being as you truly are as man.
Right.
And so ideology becomes the thing that ends up kind of holding people down. We get to structuralism, and you have the infrastructure and the superstructure seen as in dialectical relationship, and it produces a structure. The dialectical process produces a structure of society that conditions what people's experience in life is, and in fact, even the elements of their character. That would be like material determinism.
Mm-hmm.
Their character is shaped by the position that they occupy within the present social conditions, which then limit limit and constrain their subjectivity and lead them to believe that they have to, you know, this is how life is really about. The ideology, they've internalized the ideology. So they think this is, you know, I got a good job, I'm working for the man, but I get to get, you know, I get paid and da da da. And so there's both exploitation and alienation going on kind of constantly through this process of division of labor, justified in ideology. And that's kind of a big picture. This is what Marx mm-hmm. is saying is going
mm-hmm.
on,
mm-hmm.
and that this is ultimately exploitative, mm-hmm. and that if you can awaken a consciousness within that mass, but also mm-hmm. you can awaken a consciousness within the superstructural mm-hmm. players,
mm-hmm.
if you can awaken a consciousness of the actual social nature of man, and thus it will be revealed to him that this is a alienating and exploitative relationship mm-hmm. and set of circumstances, then you can have a revolution in the social conditions and come to another stage of being. And I see this as being transmuted perfectly in critical race theory. Now you have not the capitalists organizing a superstructure of society and giving all of these, you know, ideological points like meritocracy, like I earned my way into the boss position, mm-hmm. or I'm smarter than you, mm-hmm. or I came from a better family, or I'm more spiritually sensitive than you, so I get to be a priest, or any of these different things, you know, whatever it happens to be. You mm-hmm. now have that white people organize society with a principle that they would refer to as white supremacy that justifies why they get access to owning cultural property called whiteness that all others will be fundamentally excluded from. Now that's mm-hmm. Cheryl Harris's 1993 paper, mm-hmm. Whiteness as Property, mm-hmm. where she outlines that whiteness is to be considered a form of cultural property. Hmm. And that in fact, one of the key elements of whiteness as property is that it contains the fundamental right to exclude. So people of color, you're not white. And if you look back in the 50s or before the 50s, you know, obviously this was the case, you know, whites only, you know, colored water fountain, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a right to exclude. You don't have the right to be part of this upper echelon of society, you know, the Democratic Party going to the Irish in Boston and telling them, if you want to be considered white instead of us beating you as Irish, then vote Democrat. And like they document that in Critical Race here in introduction, Delgado and Stefanchik do. The Irish and the Germans both were granted access to whiteness in exchange for votes for the Democratic Party. That's literally in the, I could find the citation. It's literally in the book. Oh, yeah. I just don't, just if you actually have a copy of the book digitally, just search the word Democrat and you'll find it.
I do it all the time.
You know, well, it just stuck out. And, you know, I remember it because I laughed when I saw it because, you know, they're impugning the Democratic Party for their racism, which I was like, awkward. Mm. But what you have is that the white people have generated this entire kind of ideological structure of society. Systemic racism or structural racism becomes the structural agent. And then you have the people of color that are doing the real cultural work underneath that are being exploited and alienated from who they are. And so the fundamental premise of how Marxism operates at a as a kind of a philosophy is being reproduced perfectly with race now as the central construct for understanding inequality in place of class as the central construct for understanding inequality.
Dig it. As an entrepreneur, I love that sound. It's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business, so upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Scaling your business is now a journey of endless possibility. Like mine, Shopify powers millions of businesses, from first sale to full scale. Reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility, powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/renegade, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/renegade right now. That's shopify.com/renegade.
So I think that's a pretty good description of the ways in which critical race theorists, I suppose, think about Marxism. And I think I've seen them say this kind of stuff. They do think they're doing Marxism, and I do think they believe they've, I don't know if they would say transmuted it in that way, but they certainly do use that term. Here's the thing though, actual Marxists though, people who aren't primarily about race and primarily about critical race theory, right? The people in that world, which is a different world, it's a different world than Marxism. Marxists in academia are their own little club. Mm-hmm. And like Ben Burgess is part of that club. So he's a real Marxist, like real deal, really read all of Marx, really applies that to his own politics, thinks about politics through Marx, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They think that shit is nonsense. Right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay,
of course.
Good. Okay, then we're good. Like, as long as you know that, I knew you knew that, but just I want to be-
Workers of the world unite, not races of the world divide.
Exactly. Real Marxists think CRT is bullshit in that way. They like some elements of it, but they don't, the basic analysis of CRT makes no sense to them. As Marxism, they would never say it's Marxism. So here's why. And you kind of went through it, but I want to go through it again because it's so important, actually. So you talked about the Marx's base superstructure idea, which is that the world is roughly divided into two things. You know, there's the base, which is the economic base, the material base. That's where nature is. That's where work is. That's where materials are. That's where the weather is. Out of that, you mix your labor, one's labor with that stuff, and that produces use value, exchange value, things you can sell in the market, et cetera, whatever.
Right.
For him, that's where real shit is. That's where reality is. And that, most importantly, is what determines history. Historical change will be determined by developments in the base of society. On top of the base, as you said, is the superstructure, what he called the superstructure. And Marxists after him really developed this idea. He kind of put it out there, but he really, yeah. The idea became, as you said, you know, that the superstructure is where ideas are. It's where culture is. It's where movies are. It's where James Lindsay and Thaddeus Russell are talking about stuff, talking, right? Cultural stuff. And to him, that is essentially ephemeral and can never determine history. And therefore, revolutionaries should not pay attention to that so much. They should be worried more about what's going on in the base in terms of predicting what will happen in the future. So, for instance, in the most advanced capitalist countries with the most advanced capitalist bases, he said, they will have the first revolutions. Now, he's, of course, totally wrong about that, but that's where the analysis is. So one of the things that's part of the superstructure in the Marxist concept here is race, which is just a set of ideas over time that have changed over time, over place. People have different ideas about race. They change all but that shit is just totally in the superstructure, very ephemeral, obviously. So it's just people's ideas. It's not something, it's not a rock or it's not iron ore that you have to pull out of the earth to make a, you know, an I-beam to build a building with. It's that's the real stuff. Race is just ideas, man. So they would say, Marxists would say, yeah, to focus on race in this way, and most importantly, to claim that race is as fundamental to the working of the world as these race theorists say, is nonsense, because it's not real in that way. It's just in our minds. That's why Marxists would dump it. So, I mean, you're saying it's not really Marxism then?
No, it's race Marxism.
I see.
It's a dialectical. Okay. So like you said, Marx was ultimately wrong about where the revolution would occur, for example.
Right.
And so we know that the cultural Marxists in the 10s and 20s, 1910s and 20s, and had like a crisis there and had to try to figure out what's going on. Lukács, you got him trying to figure things out. You got Gramsci, we've talked about extensively, trying to figure things out. Mm-hmm. This proceeds to the Frankfurt School. Well, the neo-Marxists trying to figure things out. And they said, oh, well, one of the things Marx didn't understand is that the, you know, as you start to get reforms in the labor situation, the working class stabilizes itself. It loses its revolutionary energy. Mm-hmm. He didn't see this coming. And that's one of the reasons that things fall apart. Of course, Gramsci and Lukács would have said as cultural Marxists that there's this cultural hegemony. There's this force that the culture produces to be self-sustaining, that these ideas do actually somehow do something in the sense that they repel revolution. And yeah. They do so by, and they're successful at doing so because they're easy to, they're successfully transmitted from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next. And then the cultural Marx, or sorry, the neo-Marxists obviously dug into how is this the case? Well, some of it's through the commodification process. They, mm-hmm. Package up what culture is supposed to be and sell it to people. They give them cool Corvettes and they can wash them on Saturdays and they feel mm-hmm. happy about their life. As Marcuse puts it, he says, well, advanced capitalism delivers the goods. He actually says that. He says it delivers the goods. It gives people a life. And to be sure, he says it's a good life, mm-hmm. but it's not a better life, mm-hmm. right? And Horkheimer says the same thing. The working class becomes stable. People realize they work for a living. They make a good living. They get a good life. And they lose sight of the idea that they're still being exploited by this huge system. They're still being mm-hmm. alienated. That Corvette is ultimately not a reflection of who they are. It's a reflection of who Chevrolet wanted them to be so mm-hmm. that they would pay $70,000 or whatever they are these days for a Corvette. And, and meanwhile, the fat cats at Chevrolet go home laughing with the money in the bank and, mm-hmm. The stupid redneck rubes have their Corvette and feel like their life means something. But we could throw off this whole stupid system if we would consider other historical possibilities. And so this shifting, this changing of what the locus of attack would be in order to try to overthrow this very successful, like the ideology doesn't do nothing. It also evolves to maintain itself, to always make sure that, as they would say, history doesn't progress or history doesn't get made. History it's the status quo yeah. stays put. And so that's where you end up with Marcuse, writing it, whether it's in One Dimensional Man, whether it's in Repressive Tolerance, whether it's in Essay on Liberation, whether it's in Counter-Revolution Revolt, mm-hmm. all those he's talking about, we need a new working class. And where are we going to find it? He says, well, let's look at the feminists. Let's look at the racial minority. Let's look at the ghetto population. Let's look at the unemployed. Let's look at the outsiders. Let's talk about them. And I'm not going to disagree that, classically, or even not even, doesn't have to be totally classically, but, economic theory Marxists would completely reject this. But what happened is they picked up a bunch of angry identity politicians, and those people are not, and never have been, particularly known for their theoretical sophistication. Mm-hmm. They're pissed off is what they are. Mm-hmm. And the entirety of the energy in terms of kind of a productive attempt to foment some kind of a revolution fell into the hands of these people, most of whom are very wealthy, well-off, entitled brats that have nothing to do with the base. They live totally in ideas, and who are also, to just kind of tie it straight back to the original earlier roots, like Derek Bell level roots of critical race theory, who were very interested in kind of keeping certain entitlement programs alive or even advancing them considerably, like affirmative action and so on, within the law and within, well, I guess it's just all law. I don't know where, if welfare falls under the branch of law, but you know what I mean? Like all of these kind of things that government is doing. And so this, these people, whether they replaced the old Marxists in terms of being what the left is really interested in, or whether they mostly, to be honest with you, they canceled them, just like they canceled Foucault. Patricia Collins writes Black Feminist Thought, and the sayings afterwards were, well, it reproduces Foucault pretty closely in a lot of regards, but Foucault is a white man and she's a Black woman, so it's more intersectional to cite Patricia Collins and don't cite Foucault anymore. And so, you know, they basically canceled all of these people. They started calling all the Marxists vulgar. They started calling even the postmodern social constructivists vulgar constructionists. That's Kimberly Crenshaw's words.
Oh,
for in Mapping the Margins. Again, you can look it up. She says that social constructivism is, and she's criticizing postmodernism, is a vulgar constructionism because it doesn't take up the fact of the superstructural imposition of race upon this oppressed lower class.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was going to say they're not totally wrong about that, maybe. So for Marx and Marxists, you know, the most important thing about you and me is our class position. And it basically comes down to this, whether or not we own the means of production. That's what matters to them. Most importantly, either you do or you don't. Either you're a capitalist or you're a worker. If you're a worker, that means you must work in order to survive. If you're a capitalist, that means you own productive capital, which means you don't have to work. For these people, of course, race is the most important thing. Now, Marx would say that class is real, dude. Like, if you don't own the company and the factory and the stuff, you can't, no matter how hard you think about it, you can call yourself a capitalist, but you're not going to be a capitalist, right? This is real. This is base. This is material reality, guys. He would say, and whereas race, right? Oh my goodness, one day James Lindsay is Irish and therefore semi-Negro and should not be allowed to, you know, vote and whatever and get a job. And now James Lindsay, same guy, is just historically, I'm speaking, is as white as anybody and can be and should be president and whatever, you know. Things change all the time. You know, I don't need to go on about this, how ideas about race come and go. They come and go, they change all the time. So they're ephemeral. That's why Marxists say, yeah, focus on the class, on the class, on the class. It doesn't matter what color you are. It matters whether you own the means of production. Now.
And so this has been shifted into the cultural realm then.
But hang on a second. Yeah, I was going to say, so there's this word called reification, to reify, to make ideas real. Well, wouldn't you say that that's actually happened in our country, especially in the United States, that race has been made real? Not just through laws like segregation, but certainly now, I mean, those ideas have become
critical race theory.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
They become so prevalent and powerful in people's minds that these ideas, here it is, shape and determine how these people behave in the world.
Yeah. It's called structural determinism within critical race theory.
Yeah,
yeah.
Bingo.
And in fact, since we're talking Marx, and it'll send up, you know, a signal flare for everybody who understands it, just to reference back to Mapping the Margins, what does Kimberly Crenshaw say about this particular issue in that paper? She says near the end, it's a very famous paragraph, that there's a fundamental difference between I'm a person who happens to be Black and I am Black. And then spends, this is right in the middle of that vulgar constructionism thing, by the way. And so what does she say about it? Well, the first one, I'm a person who happens to be Black, she says, strains for a certain universality. In effect, I am first a person, and it therefore ignores the structural imposition of race by, you know, the structure of white supremacy. Now she says, well, what about I am Black? She says it becomes an anchor for subjectivity.
There it is.
Anchor. That's the move. For subjectivity.
That's the move right there. That's the moment when they reify it.
Yes, exactly.
That's it.
Oh, that's exactly right.
Wow. That's historic.
And so what they would say is all of the stuff that the Marxists would say about, you know, being a capitalist, having capital, et cetera, is that they would say that the real determiner underneath actual owning capital is that there's a racist superstructure that really determines who gets to have access.
Yeah.
And they sometimes will nod in the direction that class is determinant, but mostly they say if there's a class issue, it has to be analyzed through race first. Race needs to be not the only, but the central construct for understanding inequality. Yeah. It has to be made the centerpiece under analysis. And in the cultural conditions of the United States, given our sensitive racial history and how things had been going, especially from the, you know, 70s forward, it turns out that that outcompeted Marxism big time. In terms of it's both intellectual and activist cash.
What kept the slave enslaved in the United States, right? Was it his class position or the fact that he was black?
Oh, it was pretty clearly it was the fact that he's black.
Yeah, right. That was the law. You know, and it was stated very clearly and enforced as such. So yes, that was reification of an idea. And that certainly changed some people's lives, changed history, changed this country, changed the world for worse, for the worse. Yeah. So are you with that? Do you agree with that? Do you agree with this reification thing? Can ideas be made real? Mr. Anti-postmodernist, Mr. Has truth. You not only do you say race Marxism in the title, you wanted to have in the subtitle the word truth just to get me, right?
It was that I was thinking specifically, how can I bother
about me
bad the most maybe exactly. If I make this very red, very bold cover, like he would be triggered. Truth will blow him up completely. So I do think that ideas bear consequences, right? If people believe ideas, then you've seen the picture, everybody's seen the picture where there's the elephant tied to like a little folding chair. And it's just standing there like it's tied up as the, have you not seen this?
No.
This is a very famous picture on the internet. So you've got an elephant that's been chained up to like post or whatever that it can't pull out of the ground repeatedly many times. And then they just put the leash on him and on his ankle or whatever, and then tie it to a little aluminum folding chair.
Oh, wow.
And the elephant just stands there. So it's been conditioned that if the leash is on, it's not going to be able to get away. So don't even try.
Right.
And so the idea of this thing's touching me and therefore, so certainly if there's a sufficient amount of belief in a thing, then it can start to have actual impacts. If you actually say it is 1840 and you genuinely believe that black people are genuinely inferior and therefore it's the rightful and proper thing and for their best interest to be enslaved. And a lot of people believe that. And if the black people themselves are like, well, I'm just a lowly black person, I'm going to do the best I can do. You know,
they did.
Then a lot of them did. Absolutely. Then, you know, you can be put into chains quite literally by that set of ideas. And ideas, however, though, as you were saying with Marx, they do change, though. And so what I see is that I see it in the critical race theory, a very ahistorical and very cynical and pessimistic analysis of how things have changed throughout history. And they're quite explicit about this. They argue, in fact, that rather than there being, you know, through abolition and then through the civil rights movement, that racial conditions improved. They don't believe that. They believe that the racism has stayed the same, but has learned to hide itself better. The ideology got more sophisticated. And therefore, in fact, not only is it worse in a sense, but that it requires even more specialized and sophisticated tools, namely a critical theory of race, to be able to even identify that it's going on. Now, I mean, throughout the book, I will not lie, I literally refer to critical race theory is a paranoid conspiracy theory about race over and over again.
Ooh.
Because it really is. It's truly a paranoid conspiracy theory. Are there elements of truth to it about, you know, that desegregating schools is a Derrick Bell argument, one of the and Alan Freeman argument. One of the things that it resulted in was that it exposed black people to integrated schools, took away, you know, whatever they had going on successfully in all black schools, and then subjected them not only to inferior schools, but also to racism in those schools that they wouldn't have experienced otherwise. And so it had negative, you know, psychological, cultural, and even material consequences on them in addition to, you know, achieving this moral victory of desegregation. And so maybe it wasn't all good. You can be totally sensitive to the point that they're pointing at something real there and then say that they've gone completely insane to say that this is literally as bad as slavery, hiding itself better by the pretense of equality.
Mikkel Thorup has spent more than 20 years living, traveling, and doing business in more than 100 countries all over the world. He's now the host of the Expat Money Show podcast, which is a complete guide to moving your life, your business, and your wealth offshore. You'll learn how to live and do business in foreign countries and how to protect your money from government tax collectors. Mikkel will provide you with all the information you need to know about Plan B passports, legal tax mitigation, and asset protection. And right now, you can get a free special report just for unregistered listeners by going to expatmoneyshow.com/unregistered. Again, that's expatmoneyshow.com/unregistered.
I'm thinking of Ava DuVernay's movie 13th, whatever it's called, about which the argument was that it's not stupid, right? The 13th Amendment includes that provision where you can still be enslaved if you're in prison, which is true. Like you can
right,
be,
right.
Which we, you know, that's true, right? You get employed on it as a chain gang still to this day. And totally the implication is that slavery continued under another name. That's the argument of that film,
obviously,
which is
yeah.
a huge deal. And that's very much a CRT thing, right? So it does seem to me that they are clearly suggesting at least that there's not a qualitative difference between slavery and segregation and what we have now.
They speak out of both sides of their mouths on the point.
Okay.
At times they will say that things are obviously better, at least on the superficial, but then they also say that it's in some other ways worse because it's insidious and it's affecting people psychologically in ways and they aren't even aware of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's just this huge psychic drag going along, and that they're also being, you know, like you said, they're often being enslaved, or they're statistically being enslaved by the, you know, the rates of people going to prison, et cetera, without even realizing it. So they don't have any point of nucleation for their, you know, resistance or whatever. If there was actually slavery, you would have a mass right. movement to push back against this. But if it's hidden as the, well, you're a criminal and you went to prison. So, but, you know, suck it up, buttercup.
But here's the thing though. So they're right about the narrow point. I mean, that slavery,
that's how it usually goes.
Well, that slavery did continue under another name. That we do have slaves in this country right now. Thing is, you know, about half of them are white, but whatever, you know, they're known as prisoners because they're right. forced to work in prisons. We know this. That's legal to force people to work if they're in prison. Okay, so that's a structural reality. That's where race became a structural reality, because disproportionately they're black, of course, those slaves in prisons. And then segregation comes along. And that was very much making race very real for everybody in very powerful ways. So, I mean, I'm asking you, like, since then, I mean, has race been made a part of the structural reality of this country?
I don't think, well, had it been, yes. And I think that we actually moved away from the vast majority of that.
Okay.
And I think that the Civil Rights Movement and Civil Rights Acts and Voting Rights Act, et cetera, actually achieved qualitative and meaningful difference or changes in these circumstances, so that it's ahistorical to try to compare what's happening now to what was happening then. Do we reify race now? Well, critical race theory certainly does. Some people do, who are racist one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do because it's part of what they feel like is their cultural heritage. And I'm not talking about white people at this moment, although I could be, because some of them, but I had them under racists, which is kind of funny, because black people who want to take black as an anchor of their subjectivity might also be being racist in that regard as well.
Of course.
So it's, yes, it's being reified, but I think it's being, to invoke Thomas Sowell, it's being kept on life support for the purposes of people who want to use this as a form of activism.
Yeah.
And again, we go back to Crenshaw. We just use her own words, not even against her, just to clarify what's happening. What is the other thing in addition to an anchor of subjectivity that I Am Black stands for? Is it becomes a site for a meaningful politic of identity. And so it's intentionally bringing it into the realm of, well, if we think this way, if we reify race, if we make it an anchor of subjectivity, if we do this, then we can do collective identity politics. We can see ourselves, if we borrow off of Marcuse's language, as a new working class, as a radicalized minority or a radicalized base that needs, that won't be liberated until we overthrow the superstructure of society, which is whiteness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they
and the poor Marxists just lost their, I mean, I get why they would criticize the characterization, but this is this is the advantage of having an outside perspective. I'm not a Marxist. Mm-hmm. I'm not a critical race theorist. Mm-hmm. I look at these things from the outside and I can see in some regard parallels that are harder mm-hmm. to see from inside, because when you're inside, you see the differences glaring at you. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, this is how we're very different from those people. And I actually think this boils down to the dialectical nature of how they structure their ideas. That you keep some of it, you abolish some of it, you lift mm-hmm. it up to a higher level. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up with is something that's in essence, very similar, but in specific, very different. And it's very easy to like lose the forest for the trees in those kinds of circumstances. So just like you have, you know, the postmodernists also look at critical race theory and they're like, no, but Kimberly Crenshaw said, well, you're just privileged. Mm-hmm. You can't understand from your privileged white position, French man, the imposition of race. And so you don't understand how race actually works as a structural commodity. And so you don't understand anything. And so your analysis is limited. It's vulgar.
Here's how it went. Slavery, racial slavery happens. And Frederick Douglass says, no, that's based on a fiction. In fact, we black people are just the same as white people. We're the same. Right. We're the same.
Yep.
They were assimilationists too, but he wouldn't use that term. But you know, that was the claim. Yeah. We're the same. Okay. 100 years later, segregation's here. Martin Luther King stands up and says, racial segregation, says, yeah, racial segregation based on a fiction too. Mm-hmm. We're just the same as white people. Just
that's right.
And they won those arguments. And so we no right. longer have slavery or segregation based on this.
And by the way, that is liberal deconstruction is what
exactly.
That is.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah, totally. So now we have, instead of that, whatever structural racism there might be, and I do think there's maybe some, sure, maybe some, whatever there is, you know, now the response by Kimberly Crenshaw and the CRT folks is, oh no, it is real. Oh, the race is real. And in fact, I'm going to anchor my subjectivity in it. I'm going to take this category that was invented literally specifically by slave owners to justify their holding of slaves. And I'm going to continue this in perpetuity. I will always be black, which is what they labeled me. The slave masters labeled me black. And I will hold on to that. And in fact, I will make that, as she says, central to who I am as a person. I'm going to anchor my subjectivity. And so that is definitionally racism.
Yes.
Definitionally. So that's a bad move.
It's a real bad move. But then it gets worse.
Yeah.
Because that anchor for subjectivity is derived from the structure and the structuralist infrastructure plus superstructure and dialectical relationship produces structure that conditions society. So mm-hmm. now you have structural, not just material determinism at play. So the contents of your character are determined by the, you know, the very, they call these things power dynamics, but the structure of society is determined by this racist imposition, the imposition of race by white people that the black people or Kimberly Crenshaw, the critical racers, not black people, Kimberly Crenshaw and the critical race theorists are saying, no, we're going to accept this. We're going to use this. We're going to actually try to turn it upside down. And then you have this structural determinism, and then in critical race theory, it sounds insane, but this is point number like four, and it's on like page like seven or eight or something, nine or something like that. Very first 10 pages at any rate of critical mm-hmm. race theory and introduction by Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanchik. Structural determinism gives rise to what they call a unique voice of color. And so this is that because of their structural position within this superstructure versus infrastructure relationship that structural organization of society mm-hmm. because of their the word and an intersectionality for this is positionality.
Yeah.
Because of their positionality with relationship to that structure of society, they are given a unique voice of color, which is straight up master slave dialectic being reinvoked, whether you want to pin that on Rousseau, Hegel, or Marx. it doesn't really matter, because it's kind of a continuous evolution of these ideas between the three of them there. And I know other people got into it. Nietzsche talked about it as well. But so then this, what's this unique voice of color? What do you end up with? Well, you have people like Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat,
my favorite,
from wherever hell or wherever she's from, coming out and saying last year, we don't need any more black and brown faces who don't want to be black and brown voices. And we have Larry Elder run for governor against Gavin Newsom in the recall in California. And the LA Times prints what? Well, Larry Elder is the black face of white supremacy. And we have Dave Chappelle makes jokes about trans people. And somebody, I forgot who wrote this article. I need to look it up so I can actually cite them properly. But there really was an article. Maybe it wasn't something fringe, but it's still so funny that Dave Chappelle told jokes about trans people because of his white privilege. They said that. And I'm like, you like this, that literally doesn't make sense at this point. None of that makes sense. And so what do you have? Well, you're back on the plantation. It's what you have. If you are a black face or a brown face, you better have the voice that critical race theory has determined is your structurally determined unique voice of that race, of that color. Yeah. And if you're white, you have to abolish your private property. I mean, whiteness. You have to strive to be less white in the name or in the words of Robin DiAngelo and or Coca-Cola. And now, of course, this is another point where the Marxists would have a massive amount of contention with this framing, because you're like, it's all corporate. Coca-Cola is taking this up. You know, every corporation has not, no, it's no small ones. All the big corporations have taken this up. And this is a massive, massive shift from, sorry, Marxist, y'all are vulgar. You don't understand that if we want to win, if we want a revolution for real, we have to use capitalism to beat capitalism.
That's the ultimate irony here, is that these CRT folks, I mean, the vulgar ones, I don't know if Crenshaw and Bell would do this, but the vulgar ones, which is most of them, you know, they are completely serving the interests of big capital.
Big, big capital.
Big, the biggest capital. The biggest evil people in the world used to be.
The biggest banks in the world.
And the biggest pharmaceutical companies too.
Yeah, which are literally like trying to do experiments on them with this is another race-based scandal with the pharmaceutical companies, like comes out every freaking day, it seems almost. You know, like they're gonna test the vaccines on black and brown people because of systemic racism or something, and that was a thing. Oh my god, they were actually gonna prioritize access to the vaccines, which we shouldn't really call them vaccines, these injections anyway. Yeah. They were going to prioritize access based on race to overcome white supremacy. And then, of course, a lot of black people recognize this. And I've spoken with a fair number of black people, most of whom are conservatives, who immediately recognize, like, y'all doing experiments on black people again. Okay, okay, got you. You know, and then the one I just saw today was they're, you know, they're paying people in some of these cities to get the vaccine. And they'll give them a gift card or some money or whatever. So now you have disproportionately poor and then statistically disproportionately black people primarily, but some, you know, Latino or whatever else, that are going and getting like 9 vaccines so they can get more gift cards. And then it turns out some of the gift cards are empty. Like that was actually the Project Veritas expose that came out yesterday, that they were there. There are literally people getting like 5, 6, 8, 10 injections of this experimental vaccine because they're being given a gift card and disproportionate.
No,
any rich person going to go get a $50 gift card and take another dose of a thing that makes them sick? No, who does that? Poor people.
Dude, this happened. What?
This happened.
This is new. This is a new thing.
This is the new thing. It just came out last night.
Veritas
has this, and it's like they actually have people on video, like nurses coaching people on how to like change their name so they can go get another gift card by getting another injection, and then admitting, well, some of the gift cards are actually blank. They don't have any money on them. So they're giving people a fake gift card, poor people, disproportionately black, a fake empty gift card. So this is horrific. It's positively horrific. What's going on? And of course, it just proves the lie when you like, who are you supporting the interests of through these horrific narratives? Well, certainly not the people you claim to be, not real black and brown people and or communities. Same as when Black Lives Matter was burning down neighborhoods. Did they disproportionately burn down rich white people's stuff? No, they disproportionately burned down like grocery stores and things in little black communities. And like, I saw that black lady crying on TV. I'll never forget it, saying, where am I supposed to buy my groceries now? Because they burned down a grocery store in one of these riots in one of these cities. And, you know, you got all the critical race theory infused Democratic politicians saying change is supposed to be uncomfortable because there's a pedagogy of discomfort, which they learned from these same system of terrible ideas.
Pardon the interruption again, but if you would like to take the course that James and I are discussing on critical race theory at Renegade University, please go to renegadeuniversity.com/courses. We still have several seats open. Again, that's renegadeuniversity.com/courses to take critical race theory with James Lindsay and me. I'll see you in class.
That story about bribing black people to get the vax is just, that says it all in a way.
Well, I mean, Lori Lightfoot just put that creepy picture on social media last night where she wrote in $20 bills, except for one of them's a five and one of them's a one. And I don't know why.
What?
Get vaxxed on the floor in this nasty office with this greasy looking couch. And she's standing there looking all creepy, like an overhead shot coming down at a bad angle. And it's like, you get vaccinated, you have a chance to win this stack. It's like $826. You have a chance to win $826 in cash. And then Lori Lightfoot standing there in Chicago, mayor. And it's like, who's going to go get extra, possibly life-threatening injections? Like, maybe the thing is safe and effective. Let's just give them some credit. I'm betting getting 9 of them in a short amount of time is not safe and effective, but that's not a good idea. But enter again to win. And who's going to be impacted? Poor people disproportionately, because frankly, Marx was more right than the critical race theorist. Class is more determinant on how people are actually going to do things than race most of the time. And so it's just a disaster that they're going to exploit poor people, that are going to disproportionately exploit black and brown people, particularly. And then in this case, literally injecting experimental emergency use only pharmaceuticals into them at Pfizer's gigantic profits and with total legal immunity, blah, 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 for the, you know, a $20 or $50 gift card or the chance to win up to $826.
Let me say this publicly. These people are on the verge of forcing me to vote Republican.
Welcome. That's what happened to me last time.
On the verge.
I'm telling you, that's what happened to me last time. It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I haven't voted for anybody ever since 1984. Walter Mondale was the last person I voted for. Anybody. I don't vote for anybody. Republicans, I think they're dummies mostly. Pretty innocuous in general, but mostly dummies with some bad ideas. But they're the only things stopping these people. And it's MAGA especially. I mean, MAGA...
It's because MAGA is class consciousness.
MAGA says, I mean, Bannon uses the word working class every day. I watch him every day. They are totally class conscious. They talk about workers, working class this, the elites, the ruling. They don't say capitalists, but they do say elites and ruling class all the time. Also, MAGA is, as I've been studying it very closely for a year and a half now, I'm sorry, it is the most, I'd say it's the least racist of all the major political movements in this country.
It is. I've been all around. I'm in MAGA country all the time. Everybody's having fun. It's never seen anything even remotely close to racism.
And the diversity is pretty amazing, actually.
The diversity's off the charts.
Yeah. I mean, people don't realize this. They've got like a Salvadoran immigrant or something running for Congress in one of the states.
Yeah.
And they've got like all sorts of black people doing all sorts. I mean, women even got one of their main activists is clearly queer.
What's
his name? Scott Pressler, whatever his name is. Yeah, like he's clearly gay. Like, what is going on? And the funny thing is, he's very flamboyant. Like, if you live in the bi-coastal cities, like he's gonna be obviously gay, but like it's not a thing. Like, he doesn't talk about it. They don't make fun of him, they don't even mention it. It's just a thing. I mean, it's not a thing. And they'll have people various colors on the show, and it's never a thing. They never say, as a black man, as a black woman, as a black this, or they'll say, as a black man, what do you think about this? It's never, there's no race consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. None. And so what I actually think, I think that MAGA is class consciousness. I really do. And what happened was the capitalist system got oppressive enough and advanced enough to where the working class spontaneously awakened to the fact that they were getting screwed over. And so in the long run, is Marx kind of right? Well, about most of it, but not about something important. They don't want socialism. They want freedom.
Right.
They don't want an administered economy where everything's made equal. They want their own shot at their own life. They don't want to have to think about race and sex and gender and sexuality all the time. They want to get to know each other and be friends with people. They want to live their lives as humans, which wow. if you actually derive what Marx thinks becoming social man is about, is
right.
fully humanizing. It's just that Marx misunderstood what being humanized actually represented. They want freedom.
Whoa.
And it's, so it looks like it is an inversion of class consciousness in a very real way. You can tell the left doesn't know what to do about it except to freak the hell out, because it is their thing has come to life against them.
Damn.
And as always, you know, they would say Marcuse would come on and say that what's happened, like the Great Reset is blatantly Marcuse, right? But he would say, no, it's co-optation or whatever. Like, it wasn't co-opted. It was always totalitarian, you hack. It wasn't co-opted.
I love this, dude. Check this out. So the nationalist populist movement, which is MAGA, is just a part of that. The nationalist mm-hmm. populist movement, guess what it is, guys? It's an international, it's a global movement of working class people primarily. What does that sound like? This is Marx's working class revolution, brother. I can't believe you saw this. This is amazing. I didn't even think about this.
I saw it a long time ago and people literally thought I was totally nuts.
No,
MAGA's class consciousness. That's one of those things I put on Twitter that people like Ben go berserk on me for. And I'm like, nope, well, I'm right.
I knew they were class conscious, but to see it as a revolution, as a working class revolution that's the thing. With this one crucial difference, right? Which is that they're interested in freedom rather than equality.
That's right.
Damn.
That's right.
Love it.
And
we got to have Bannon on the show.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Bannon just followed me on Getter, which I don't use, but
did he?
Yeah. So
let's do
out.
Something. Let's do something with Bannon. I think we're going to do conferences. We're going to do conferences at RU. So yeah, this will be amazing. Cool.
So this is the if we look at Marx's historicism, there's another parallelism here then, right? So of course Marx has the six stages of history. I don't even totally disagree with the ones where he was looking backwards. Mm-hmm. Like, it's facile in a way, you know, primitive communism in the mm-hmm. tribes, etc. They start dominating each other. You got slave economies. Sooner or later an aristocracy rises and they're like, maybe slavery is really bad, so let's just do it and call them serfs instead, you know. And now you have estates, and so you're in a third stage of history, and then finally the serfs are like, screw you, we have our own, let us do our best with our own. And you have, you know, private property is extended to basically everybody, citizenship is extended to everybody, not just property holders, etc. You enter into the stage of four, capitalism, and then Marx says there's going to be the revolution, and we're going to enter into an administered economy of socialism that's ultimately a transition to where that mm-hmm. enforced equality becomes spontaneous, at which point we no longer have need for a state to manage it, and we no longer have classes because they've been obliterated through the equality. They've become unnecessary, and people are fully socially awakened. And as being fully socially awakened, they realize that, you know, all for one for all, or however you want to phrase it. Mm-hmm. And so we enter into the final stage of history. I think critical race theory reproduces this same thing. Again, it's strange. If you're in the tribe, doesn't matter what you look like. If you went through the rite of passage, we have all these, you know, white people in Canada who are part of Native American tribes because, you know, they collaborated with the tribe and were friends mm-hmm. with the tribe, and they went through the ritual, and now they're just part of the tribe and they can do all the stuff. So primitive, you know, racial equality, or racial, well, we'll leave it at equality for the moment. Then eventually people are enslaving each other. People say that's not that good. We have abolition, and we enter into an apartheid state, segregation. What's that? What is that though? You have a set of racial aristocrats. You have a racial aristocracy, mm-hmm. and then everybody else is the serfs, the racial serfs. And then eventually we have a civil rights movement. We end up in what? Colorblind equality. Of course, what's going to happen there? Well, we don't have all of the racial issues they've not all been resolved. There's hangovers mm-hmm. from the past. There's continuing racism. Not everybody's on board, blah, blah, blah. What are we going to do? We're going to enter into, we'll have a revolution. Then we'll enter into an administered state where we redistribute both material and now cultural resources. And we'll enter into an administered economy, cultural and material economy called equity. And on the other side of equity, it'll eventually become spontaneous long down the road, and we'll finally have racial justice. And it's like, it's the same stupid model,
which
it's literally the same.
Pure communism, right? That's what that is. Right. Yeah.
And so now we come back to, why is this red?
Gotcha.
With the Bolshevism? Okay. Read Ibram Kendi, 2019. He writes a thing for Politico magazine. It's called like how to, they have a series, how to fix inequality is his question. He says, pass an anti-racist constitutional amendment. This was very famous when it happened. People have made fun of it quite a lot. We need an anti-racist constitutional amendment, he says.
Right.
What is it going to do? First thing it does is it's going to recognize the races as equals. I don't think anybody has a problem with this. Mm-hmm. And then it says, and it will judge racial inequity as proof of discrimination. That's not good. Like the answer to what happened is racism, right? Which led me to make the joke of, well, somebody else made it and I made a meme of it. So I want to give credit properly. Somebody on Twitter gave Kendi's razor, which is, you know, the simplest possible explanation is the right one and it's racism, but something like that. So anyway, what does Kendi say this is going to do? It's going to create a department of anti-racism composed of formally trained experts and no political appointees. Who are those going to be? Critical race theorists and so-called anti-racists, right?
Yep.
And so you have the anti-racists get to run the DOA. That's what he calls it, Department of Anti-Racism. And what is the DOA going to do? It's going to monitor public policy, monitor expressions of public officials, monitor private policy, be charged with pre-clearing all local, state, and federal policy to make sure in all cases that racist ideas and racist, meaning racially inequitable outcomes, don't occur. And it will be empowered with disciplinary tools to wield over people, situations where inequity surfaces or people who won't voluntarily change, that's his own words, voluntarily change their racist ideas and policies. That sounds an awful lot like, okay, so DOA, Department of Anti-Racism, or dictatorship of the anti-racists, in a perfect parallel to dictatorship of the proletariat. The dictatorship of the proletariat will enforce socialism, in other words, material equity. The dictatorship of the anti-racist will enforce racial equity. And when it becomes spontaneous at the end of the communist rainbow, we'll have racial justice. It's the same. So why race Marxism? Because it is a direct importation of Marxist philosophy onto racist identity politics and run by stupid grifters. And so why the national Bolshevist flag? Because the Bolshevists are stupid grifters. And they're the elite vanguard. They are the dictatorship of the proletariat, self-appointed. And so now you have a dictatorship of the anti-racists that are self-appointed experts on anti-racism with no political appointees. And it's like, geez, wow, we have a recreation of Bolshevism. And you say, but what about the national part? Well, if you start thinking as W.E.B. Du Bois kind of does, where he talks about, is it possible to be a Negro and an American? And you remember that W.E.B. Du Bois, brilliant guy, leaves America, goes to Germany for 2 years and to do a PhD that he ends up finishing at Harvard, first black PhD from Harvard, doesn't finish it in Germany for a variety of reasons that I don't think anybody ascribes it to racism. It just didn't work out. But what did he study when he was there? German nationalism, in particular Herder. And
know that.
Why, have you ever seen pictures of W.E.B. Du Bois? And you're like, why does he look like he's dressing like an Asian man?
No,
he's not. He's dressing like the Kaiser. He fell in love with German nationalism.
Shut up.
So he saw, and if you study critical race theory, you'll see it. They see the races like cultural nations, as folk. And what do they say? Black and brown folks, white folks. Why? Because it's Volkish nationalism.
Dude, what?
I didn't pick my cover arbitrarily to trigger you, it turns out.
Wait a second. But the nationalism is anti-Marxist.
Well, you see, this is the thing. The nations here are racial groups. They're not nations.
Okay.
Like the United States, bad. Gotcha. Europe, any of the given nations, bad. Britain, bad.
Right.
But China, don't talk about.
But the black nation is good.
Black nation, good.
Right.
White nation is the problem.
Gotcha.
And so what there will be in the end, though, through the dialectical process of causing this master-slave dialectic to play out across the racial divide that they're stoking, is you'll end up having, for a while, there's going to be something like racial nations while you're administering the equity state. But eventually it becomes irrelevant. We have a stateless, classless racial justice society where it's no longer an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But that's on the other side of the rainbow. I call that the communist spontaneity thesis, by the way.
I'm, or, Yeah.
That enforced equality eventually becomes spontaneous as man becomes a new man or a socialized man. And therefore the state and so on become redundant because it's now spontaneous and you don't need an administer any longer.
I'm going to do what Joe Rogan always does to me and a lot of people, like, and he probably has done it to you too. It's like, it's this very like kindly paternalism, right? Where it's like, Joe will like always tell me, like, I got to do a new workout regime. I got to take testosterone. I got to buy a kettlebell, whatever, you know. But he's also concerned about like people getting their ideas out, you know, like with Alex Jones, he was very concerned about like Alex, because he respects Jones's ideas, as I do too. And but like the way he presents them alienates like most of the world, right? So you have convinced me, my friend, okay, over the last hour that yes, it can be called race Marxism. Yes, it is part of that lineage. The argument works for me now. But the thing is, man, like the book after the cover is, I'm sure it's rigorous and brilliant like all your work is, and at least worthy of serious consideration, the very least, by anybody who knows this stuff. But that cover, brother, it is going to just stop anybody, even vaguely on the left, from opening it. Don't you think?
Yeah, but I'm not going to reach them anyway. And this okay. is the trick. Right. They will be dragged along kicking and screaming when everybody else goes along with it. And believe you me, people on the right are going to take this up and they're going to have very sophisticated arguments. They're going to be very difficult for the left to deal with as this goes out. And so they're going to come along. They don't have to come to my book. They're going to come along kicking and screaming with the arguments that I'm going to throw into the world. Because I actually, just like I have these epiphanies about what Twitter really represents, I also have these epiphanies, had these epiphanies about my ability to reach the people that I either call very smart people or the respectability class or, you know, the left in general. People are very resistant these days. I mean, you and I have a friendship, so you'll listen to me and you respect how I think. And so whatever. And actually, most of the left-leaning people, not all, that I've met in person and I sit and talk with, will have this experience and they'll listen to me to a degree or whatever. But I think it's going to have to come along. Otherwise, it's like I said before, I think I just have to keep bullying forward in my own kind of, I think it's funny, but, you know, way that I do. And I've decided, though, like, for example, that my job is not to persuade the left. It's my job to put arguments out there that ultimately the left has to deal with and will probably be persuaded by. If I try to, I mean, I used to try to persuade them and it drove me to the edge of batty. Like it literally almost made me crazy because it was just so profoundly like, you know, it'd be like, you'd go like, I convinced you, but we would go along and we'd go along, and we'd go along, and we'd go along. And then all of a sudden it would be like the rubber band just snapped. It just went backwards. Mm, like I completely lost them. And then like they're calling me names or something. Right. And that's unfortunate, but I don't know. Maybe it's just my character flaw, my shortcoming. Maybe I'll level up in a year or two. I told you this, I think. I know I've told other people this, but I think I told you this before too, is that when the so-called, to paraphrase Marcuse again, the clownish forms are no longer serving, right? So he says that the antinomian revolution will have certain clownish forms that annoy the establishment. Mm-hmm. Well, is that not my Twitter?
yep, indeed.
So when the clownish forms, though, are not serving, when they become cringe, I'm going to abandon them.
Okay.
And then it's not just a means to an end. I actually think that it's like, kind of like with, you know, whether it's Voltaire or whoever, that when you're, it's, I said it earlier, when you're being told something you can't do,
yeah,
it's A, necessary. And B, frankly, once you get over the slings and arrows, it's actually fun to do the thing skillfully that you've been told not to do, not to just be crass, not like, oh, let me just get a Confederate flag and fly it around like a Nazi flag in one hand. Like, you know, it's just crude, but to like dance around in the edges of not supposed to is fun.
Right. I mean, I don't think, you know, Joy Reid and the editorial board of Jacobin will ever be convinced of anything by you.
No.
But here's the thing though, Matt. So I do think you might be missing an opportunity here. I think we're in a special moment over the last like 6 months to a year.
This is possible.
I strongly suspect, and I've seen some evidence to suggest this, some quite striking evidence, that there are people who are sort of on the soft left, not really committed, but kind of like just there sort of culturally, who are red pilling real fast, real fast. I think that COVID, I think that Kyle Rittenhouse, I think turned a bunch of people. And I think there's a bunch of people who come from places like Berkeley and, you know, New York City and whatever, you know, who are of that milieu, who it's just too much. I think they're ready.
Right.
Right. And that's why I worry about your cover. That's all.
Well, yeah, I understand. I understand.
That's all.
We tried with a couple other examples, you know, a couple other designs, but we really wanted that bold. I mean, provocative is still sort of my brand. So we'll see. If it was an error, we can revise it.
It reminds me totally of when Jonah Goldberg had his liberal fascism book out and he went on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And Jon Stewart, I swear to God, he spends the first 10 minutes holding the book up and talking about the cover. And Jonah Goldberg says, oh, so you're judging the book by the cover, huh?
That's funny.
And he really was.
I would kind of enjoy that, though, because like you just did that and I blew your mind.
I know. Well,
so the thing is like I told you early on, it's like I know why I did what I did. So
yeah,
I can like I didn't do it arbitrarily.
Sure, but I mean, not everybody's me. That's the problem.
Well, that's true.
But that's okay. I do, man. Hey, man, you got more Twitter followers than I do. Yeah, you got more Twitter followers than I do. Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah.
Last 5 or 10 minutes here. So the regime, I mentioned that I do think that lots and lots of people are getting red-pilled. I could be wrong, but it sure seems that way.
Dude,
I mean, I know I met people like here who were like shocking, like a young black woman who grew up in Berkeley, who's like completely woke, used to like, I think she said she used to beat up white people in the street randomly. Like,
whoa.
She's totally not. She's completely over here now. I mean, she sees that it's all nonsense to her. Yeah.
I'm hearing people almost every day. Somebody will send me, you know, a private message, or I'll see it on Twitter from somebody I follow, or mm-hmm. they got retweeted by somebody I follow, mm-hmm. or somebody saying, I'm pretty sure I'll never be able to vote for a Democrat again. Like what they've done. I will never be able to vote. Like, I don't even have that hard line of a stance. Like their path to redemption for me is a long and hard one, but I would never say never. But no, people are like just slamming the door. Like, nope, never voting for a Democrat again in my life.
Well, this iteration of the Democratic Party, I mean, forget about it. There's no
chance. Oh, for sure. I mean, I voted for Trump.
I mean, I don't like any of the Democrats ever, but this is the worst for sure.
Speaking of Trump news, since we like to do that,
yeah,
I went to Mar-a-Lago.
Did you really?
You said, you know, what are kind of interested before we started, you asked if I had any like, famous stuff. I forgot. Yeah. I went to Mar-a-Lago in December. That was fun.
He invited you?
I went as a guest with somebody that was invited. So I was the plus one for somebody.
Oh, okay.
So no, but he called when we were out to dinner. So I might meet him. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. What happened there?
It was a fundraiser for Ken Paxton. So fundraiser for Ken Paxton, things happened. Trump came out and gave a talk. Turns out he's really funny. He's really, really funny.
Oh, I know.
And, you know, it was hot and sweaty. It's, you know, it's in West Palm Beach. It's hot and but it was fun. Everybody's in suits, glad handing and carrying on.
Wow.
It's cool. It's just kind of it's a neat place to go. I will tell you, you know, people don't believe that I actually came from the left as well myself.
I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
But so Mar-a-Lago is beautiful. Okay. It's just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I swear to God, the first thing I thought, we pulled up in the drive, you know, to park or whatever, or to get valeted or whatever it is that you do. And I was like, okay, wow, cool. And then I walked in. It's all outside. So we walked through, right? But so we walked into the building and I looked around and the first thing I thought was this place shouldn't exist. Like very Bernie Sanders, this should not be billionaires. Like this place shouldn't exist. Like this is a concentration of resources. It's just preposterous. Right. Mm-hmm, and then I was like thinking like comparing it to like Buckingham Palace or, you know, any of the grand palaces. And I thought, it's kind of neat that we have a little bit of that going on here. But you know, if you say 5-star, this is like 6 or 7 stars. It's like,
really,
it's next level fancy. It's like, whoa, this place is off the charts. Trump's really proud of it. He came out and he talked about the sculptors, like, you'd think everybody thinks he's an idiot. He's coming out talking in like in depth about who the sculptors were that made the statues that are on the property and how they were done and how they don't use these techniques anymore. And this technique can do that. And it looks really good. And you can see how it has this particular, you know, feel to it. And it's like, it was actually like it was Trump speak, but it was, you know, sophisticated aesthetic analysis of what's going on and, you know, clear knowledge about the history of the place and pride in it. And, you know, it was kind of cool.
Never heard that before. I've never heard anything about Mar-a-Lago before. So, but you're basically just proving that you're selling out.
Well, I didn't get anything out of it except to go there. But
they're gonna clip this and say, oh, this is what Lindsay's about. He's just trying to get
paid. They told me they said that I voted for Trump because he retweeted me once. No, I didn't. I voted for Trump because the Democrats said they wanted to abolish the Constitution.
I believe you. Yeah, don't you think? I mean, the Republicans are clearly gonna win Congress in November. right? And I think a healthy number of MAGA people will be in Congress now, like a huge number of MAGA people. I don't know exactly how many, but Bannon keeps talking about 100 seats, meaning flipping 100 seats, which will ensure that they dominate government for 100 years. That's his thing. 100 seats, 100 years.
Yeah,
it's really going to happen. I mean, I think it's going to happen.
That's why the primaries are so important, because the regime will try to stick as many Mitt Romneys into primary positions as possible. And then the second place where that matters then is where they can't get the primary, and they can't get a Mitt Romney character through. What they're going to do is they're going to start building out transition teams and appointee teams and all of this, so that establishment types get stuck in underneath. That's what they did to Trump. Mm-hmm. Paul Ryan took over the PPO, the Presidential Personnel Office, right before all of that, because he knows it's the most powerful position in Washington. Trump got elected, and 3,000 plus of his 5,000 appointees were appointed by the swamp. And you saw the shit show that proceeded from that. And so,
yeah, but I don't think they're going to stop the wave entirely. I think you're going to,
it's going to be hard.
You're going to have a Republican Congress, and then you're going to have, here's the thing. You're going to have MAGA people on the oversight committees, the government over, like Ron Johnson with teeth. Then we'll have subpoena like power.
And MTG. I met her too, by the way.
Did you? Yeah. MTG.
Yeah, Marjorie's cool.
I'm sure.
She's just a normal person. She's just a normal person. I don't understand. Well, I do understand why they hate her so much. And it's because, well, she is a bit nutty with the Q stuff.
She gets a little out there on some things. She's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's okay. Welcome to America. Right.
Sure.
to America. And so, but no, one of the things that they hate her so bad for is that she figured out that if anybody in Congress calls for a particular kind of vote where everybody has to show up and actually put their name by what they voted for, they have to do it. It was she and Thomas Massey who make sure that happens in virtually every House vote. And so they hate her. They absolutely hate her.
No,
she's a nice lady. I met her. We had a nice little conversation for a few minutes. It was cool. I'm to this point now where I don't want to judge any of these people. I mean, granted, you got to be careful meeting a politician at all. And then but it's like, I don't want to judge people until I get, you know, a little sense of them personally, unless they're doing something blatantly criminal or whatever. Like, I'll happily judge Nancy Pelosi just based on whatever she's got going on with stocks. And it's not Democrat thing, because I'm judging Dan Crenshaw too, who's also somehow beating the market to like unbelievable amounts that can't possibly be. Like, that's the kind of thing that if you came even like a small fraction of that level of success of beating the market as an individual, that the SEC is going to make a phone call to you. And they're like blowing it out of the water on gigantic trades while in Congress. Like, okay, bad people.
Yeah.
And that, like I said, I just named a Democrat and a Republican. So it's not even a partisan thing there. If you're corrupt, I'll judge you from afar. But
you know, never to trust a politician, though.
No, never trust.
Okay.
Well, that's even, the thing about
no matter who they
MTG,
are.
MTG, like, I don't, well, she may become one, but she's not a politician yet.
Well, anyway, I feel you generally. So wait, your politics, I never actually asked you this, really. What were your politics before all this?
I was a pretty, like, I would say that I was kind of like whatever the mainline sort of scientific people who call themselves left liberals.
Oh, yeah?
Would be. Yeah. I mean, being scientific, I would have been like science, evidence, da-da-da, not like where you would have been like, hold on, Foucault says, you know.
No, but I mean, but like, what positions did you take on issues? For instance,
more or less whatever the Democratic Party was saying was a good idea, or whatever the Republican Party really hated.
Wow.
Pretty simplistic.
Until when?
I started to get suspicious of their positions when I started to notice, because obviously with the grievance studies affair, et cetera, kind of peered behind the curtain of the studies. I still was all like, no, climate science is different. That's in a different category, blah, blah, blah. But I was like watching them, the Democrats start to tout gender ideology quite explicitly. Okay. And some of the, you know, various aspects of like racial equity quite explicitly. I started to get nervous about them, but it was really, you know, 2019, I started to actually meet Republicans. This is a really funny thing. We talked about how MAGA is, you know, you don't see any racism. I remember I got taken. I didn't intend to go. I just happened to be in DC at the time for something else. And my guys were, my team was around. We were hanging out. It was like, CPAC is in town. Do you want to go? Like, just as a lark, like, haha, James is going to CPAC. And I was like, hey, what the hell? Let's go check it out for a few hours. right? So we got like a day pass, whatever that costs. We all went in for like 5 or 6 hours and walked around, and I talked to people, and I came out. I mean, I thought the people were like Republican crazy people, but I came out of there, the overwhelming impression, we sat down at, you know, dinner and drinks or whatever later, and like, what'd you think? And I was like, I got lied to. Like, about what? About Republicans.
Yeah.
Like, I got, it was nothing. Like, I thought it was gonna be like a Klan rally or something, like literally. And so, you know, not very sophisticated politically, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
it was just whatever the Democrats were saying. Oh, we have to do this about climate change. Yeah, we have to do this about climate change, you know, and whatever, immigration, da, da, da. Well, the Republicans just hate brown people. You know, it was that stupid and low information and simplistic. So, you know, it's my fault. I'd eat all of the responsibility for that. But the truth of the thing is, bro, I majored in math. Like, I didn't care. It is not easy. And I know I'm not trying to like prop myself up. It is not easy to get a PhD in math.
So
I finished my bachelor's degree and was kind of like, really? And I finished my master's degree and I was kind of like, I even remember grimly laughing, like, that wasn't very hard. Like, this is a master's degree. I finished the PhD and I came home after I defended my dissertation and my wife asked me, you know, how'd it go or whatever. And I just looked at her and I was like, they don't give these away. And she was like, what do you mean? I was like, they give master's degrees away. Like, you show up, you play around for 2 years, here's your master's degree. They don't give those away. So I didn't have time to think about anything except mathematics until I was like 30 something.
Sure.
It was a consummate academic pigeonholed in my field. And so I started getting politically active because I was mad the Republicans were trying to put Jesus back into the schools instead of evolution. And so obviously the Republicans just became the avatars of evil.
Right.
George Bush had just been president and that was a catastrophe.
Right.
Obama's coming along and look how great everything is. Little did we know. And so, you know, that was basically my low information, but highly educated and super smug politics. Sort of embarrassing to look back at it, but it's like, I didn't have freaking time. Like, I'm trying to learn fucking probability theory. I don't have time for this.
And then you became the world's leading expert on critical race theory.
Yeah, it's really not expected. But that's, you know, I actually feel like it's a testament to a character trait of mine that is very commendable, which is that because of the grievance studies affair, you know, I had some knowledge, but very inadequate knowledge of what's going on in these theories, right? But I was thrust into a national spotlight. It was not this quest of how do I maintain the spotlight as long as I can. I can actually tell you it was the freaking pedagogy of discomfort that radicalized me. What radicalized you? The pedagogy of discomfort. The idea that you were going to intentionally make kids uncomfortable to overcome their privilege through often somewhat sadistic methods in schools. And that's on purpose. That radicalized me. So I became thrust into a spotlight. And I wanted to be able to talk about the things that people wanted me to talk about intelligibly. I wanted to actually, if I'm going to talk about critical race theory, if I'm going to get asked about it, I'm going to go read it first. And so Helen and I, you know, I'd already signed on to help Helen write Cynical Theories, which was originally going to be a different project. It was hers. And I was just going to help her and edit. Like, I wasn't a co-author originally. And then I got so involved and she appreciated what I was doing so much, I became a co-author and I was reading the texts alongside her. So we were reading Foucault, we were reading Derrida, we were reading, you know, Baudrillard and whatever else, but we were also reading critical race theory. We were reading queer theory. We were reading, you know, so Gail Rubin, Judith Butler, whatever else, we're reading this stuff. And it's like, I'm getting a grasp of what's going on. And then what happened actually, what really changed everything. And this is ultimately where the cleaving between Helen and I came from, was somebody gave me a copy of Repressive Tolerance. And they said, read this and see what you think.
That'll
and I read it and I was like,
that'll do it.
Oh, I read it on a flight. They told me to go find it online and read it. And I opened it up on my phone and I read it on my phone on a flight home. And I was like, oh my God. Not only is this the logic of the world we live in, this is straight totalitarianism. And so all of a sudden it was like, well, now I have to study critical theory. And so then, you know, you very kindly asked me to come in and do the course with you on postmodernism and critical theory. So I read even more and I read more. And then, you know, we had this incident on the show where it's like, I was a little unclear about what the Dialectic of Enlightenment was about. So I went after that. This is just that character I'm talking about. I went and reread the Dialectic of Enlightenment because apparently I didn't quite get it good enough to explain it in a comprehensive way when put on the spot. It's like, I gave an okay answer, but I didn't feel confident. So I went and read the book again. And like, this is what I do. So I put on Twitter recently that I thought that there's an element where, look at the book cover, the red and the Nazi element to what's going on in critical race theory or wokeism. And so what did I do? I went and read Mein Kampf. Like I literally picked up Mein Kampf and I haven't read it in like 5 years. So I read it again. And what happened when I read it again? I was like, no, I was actually not quite right. And so there's actually a section in Race Marxism where I talk about the parallels between all of these Volkish nationalism and the races and all this, the parallels between what looks like National Socialism and wokeism. But then I conclude, no, it's not National Socialist, not woke. Now you want to talk about the regime. You want to talk about the Great Reset. You want to talk about the Klaus Schwab. A little closer.
Yeah. Dude, we got to wrap here. This has been amazing. I love talking to you. It's always so fun. And I can't wait to teach this course with you.
Yeah, it's going to be a wild ride.
Everybody go to renegadeuniversity.com and check it out. It's coming right up right after this episode is released. So that's going to be something else. Got to run. Thank you so much, brother. I will see you very soon.
Yep. Likewise.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.